Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Seth Markson, and you're about to listen to the first episode, the inaugural episode of my podcast. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Seth Markson Podcast.
This episode features guest Chris Fisher. Chris is a sports broadcaster for the Pac-12 Network and the official play-by-play announcer for USC men's basketball. Though Chris's life has revolved around sports, his path to where he stands now was not the easiest. At the age of 17, Chris was in a car accident that paralyzed him from the waist down. In our conversation, he explains that experience and what it was like to persevere and chase his dream to become a sports broadcaster. Let's get it started. Chris Fisher. What's up, man?
Not too much. Glad to be here.
Thanks for coming by. Definitely want to talk to you about sports, everything that you do. I think you've got such a cool story. So,
is there some reason you had to wear an Arizona Cardinals shirt?
Hell yeah, because that's my team, bro.
Okay.
Yeah, they're my squad. I've watched them since I was a young kid. I was actually watching them since 1995. I remember my dad had season tickets and we were watching them at Sun Devil Stadium in Arizona, like when it was hot as hell, like 170 degrees, and even like the players didn't even want to be outside because it was so hot.
Back when they're the Phoenix Cardinals. Yeah. You know what I still can't believe, and I was just in Arizona and we were talking about this, is how they had a Super Bowl in that stadium.
Isn't that nuts?
We were driving through Tempe, and you drive up to Sun Devil Stadium now, and it's tiny. You go in there, it's not that big. And they had Super Bowl 30 there between the Cowboys and the Steelers. Yeah. And we were all just like, you couldn't even fathom having a Super Bowl there now. And that was in 95.
Right.
The 95 season going in the 96 Super Bowl. And that place is so tiny. We're all like, there's no way you could do that now.
Yeah. And you know, what's funny is that our camera guy, Adam over here, he's a big Cowboys fan. He's a huge Cowboys fan. So, you know, you're taking
him back. Why do you let him in?
I don't know. I think I just left the door unlocked. That's my bad. But, what's crazy is that Larry Fitzgerald actually joined the Cardinals before the new stadium was built. And to think that, you know, who were the players left that actually played in that stadium? It's like Larry Fitzgerald, and that might even be it. I don't think any other player on the roster now is.
Nobody has that kind of longevity.
No.
In the NFL now.
Even in athletics, that guy is just insane. He's awesome.
Totally. I'm glad to hear that he's coming back another year.
Oh, my God.
Even though they don't have a quarterback.
Yeah, well, maybe he can throw the ball too. We'll see what happens on that end. But so what is it that you do?
Well, considering we're talking about sports, I happen to be in that field as well. I work as a sports broadcaster on the radio for USC, particularly USC men's basketball, USC football. I do TV work for Pac-12 Network, broadcasting some of their college basketball games, done a little work for Fox over the years. So staying busy. This is the busiest time of the year, obviously, with college hoops in full swing and the tournament right around the corner, and USC trying to get to the NCAA tournament. So it's kind of, you know, every single game you're on the edge of your seat a little bit. But been doing it now for about, this is my eighth year doing USC hoops, which, you know, it's been a lot of futility over the years, but these last couple have been good, trying to get to the NCAA tournament for the third consecutive time. And We'll see if they can get there. But, you know, it's a very fortunate position because a lot of people want to do it. Who doesn't want to get paid to go to a sporting event?
And right.
It's kind of like one of those industry secrets. We don't like to talk about how good we have it, but we got it pretty good, and USC takes care of me. So I can't complain. I can't complain one bit.
It's so cool, and especially to be right there with the team who's really fighting to try and get there. I mean, you've got to be on the edge of your seat, just like all the fans in the stadium. That's kind of cool.
You know, what's interesting is you hear coaches and you hear people that are involved in sports talk about, quote, the journey and what does that entail and from start to finish on a season. And when you are a fan on the outside looking in, it's, you know, you have your emotions and you have kind of what brings you through the week to get you to the games and through the games and this and that. But when you're on the inside of a team or an organization, the emotions are totally different because you're dealing with the coaches, you're dealing with the players, and that ride becomes even more personal. And whether it's good or bad, it hits you in a different way than, you know, you being probably a Cardinals fan. Mm-hmm. Not just because your paycheck's coming from there, but because you know these people on a more intimate level.
Right.
And your day-to-day job is very much dealing with them and being at the outcome of the game and all of those kind of emotions. And I will say this, that being a part of a team and the highs and lows of a season, the ups and downs, the wins and the losses, it has way more meaning to me than just being a casual fan. Like when you are in it on a daily basis like that, it makes such a big difference. And, you know, losing the NCAA tournament like we did the last couple of years, it was totally different feeling than any other kind of feeling because you're like, well, that's it. And that's the last time we're going to be with these guys and they're going to move on. They're going to start living their lives. And it just, the ebbs and flows of a season, there's nothing like it. And it puts a lot more meaning on what I do. And I think the other people that are involved in what they do. So when you hear the journey coming from people like coaches and the players, it's a journey that I think really exists.
Yeah. Well, do you keep in touch with a lot of the guys that you have done broadcasting with or for, you know, any of these players or coaches?
I think that along the way you see familiar faces that you know you're going to see certain people in certain towns.
Yeah.
That are just there. For example, when I go to Oregon, I will always get in touch with the beat writer from the Register Guard, Steve Mims, who has become a friend of mine over the years. And, you know, you kind of get used to seeing those familiar faces. Coaches, if they move on, you don't necessarily see them because they're doing a different team or something like that. The players move on. Every once in a while, they'll peep their head back into the arena and you chop it up with them for a little bit. But it's a storm that keeps on moving.
Right.
It's definitely a storm that keeps on moving. But, you know, you appreciate the people that you work with and hopefully that, you know, it's people that you like to be around. I was kind of a part of this perfect storm right at the perfect moment of when this thing really took off like a rocket ship. I mean, this thing, Pete Carroll and USC, they weren't Pete Carroll and USC back in 2003, 2004. It was that 2004 season that really launched everything on a whole different trajectory, going into 2005, winning the national championship, and then that season 2005 that set up the Rose Bowl with Vince Young.
Yeah.
That was Hollywood. It was glitz. It was glamour. It was Heisman trophies. It was LA. It was the biggest thing in town, and it put USC on a whole different level. And USC was the most popular thing in town for everybody. Everybody wanted to be a part of the sideline. Everyone wanted to be a part of USC. And I was fortunate that I got to be a part of it. I was around the football team, and I worked for the student radio station at the time and worked for the video department. And it brought USC recognition, notoriety. People wanted to be a part of it. It's hard as hell to get in now. I wouldn't even get in, I don't think, because the admission standards are so much higher.
It's like, I saw it. It was like 16.4%. That's the admission. That's the acceptance rate.
I would not get in. Like, and we all joke about it now because, you know, the people that went to USC that were there before that, you know, what would it take to get us in? We'd have to, like, grease the wheels with all of our contacts to get in, you know? We'd have to do everything we possibly could. But it was a fun time. It was the perfect time. I lost 5 games my whole college career there.
Oh, my God.
5 games. So 04, 05, 06, 07. They went undefeated in 2004. They lost the Rose Bowl in 2005, and then they lost 2 each in 06 and 07. So it was the perfect time to be there. And
yeah, you guys were literally like kings of the hill.
Well,
in football for sure.
It was king. It was definitely king of the castle, and it was an incredible run. 34 consecutive games, 2 Heisman Trophy winners on the same team. And as impressive as what Alabama's doing it now on a longer, more sustained level, because of the quantity of national championships that Nick Saban is racking up. But that stretch of USC 03, 04, 05, to me, I mean, they were even though they lost to Texas, even though they lost to UCLA at the last game of the regular season, 06, they were still the best teams in the country for that short period of time. I mean, 34 games in a row. Could you imagine a team winning 34 games in a row right now
in
college football?
College football, let alone any sport. That's just incredible. I mean, 34
games in a row was ridiculous. And, you know, that's what got the attention. Nobody expected them to lose. You always expected them to figure it out. But two Heisman Trophy winners on the same team is just ridiculous.
Right. And, like, and you know, even now, as you were talking about Alabama, it's like you just kind of expect them to be in the playoff, let alone the championship game.
Now, you know? Absolutely. I mean, it is the ultimate reload program. One recruiting class after another of elite talent, of big, physical, strong athletes who just totally look like they're better than their opponent year after year after year. And they fit into that system, and they get coached up extremely well by Nick Saban and his crew. And it's not a fluke.
Right.
It's not a fluke.
Now, have you ever had the privilege to broadcast football, or has that been in the back of your mind?
Done a little bit, did a lot more when I was younger. But it's been primarily baseball since I graduated, because that was my first job out of college. And then baseball had a funny way of segueing into basketball.
Yeah.
And football over the years hasn't been as much of a play-by-play priority. I do some hosting for USC football halftime and postgame show, but it's been mostly hoops and baseball.
Oh, wow. Okay. But you're clearly a fan of just all sports, it seems like.
If there's a competition, I'm probably trying to get involved somehow.
Right, like when did you broadcast the Mathalon?
Yeah, right, you know? Exactly. Like I could broadcast the old card game of war.
Yeah.
You know, I just did not want to lose. In some ways, you have to find that itch to get out the competitive juices. And I mean, it doesn't matter. I'll watch anything that can somehow get that itch done for me.
It's almost safe to say, if you're a sport fan, that levels you with absolutely anybody. Like, the president of any country, if they're a sports fan, you can find an even ground and talk to that person.
Easy way to find common ground. Easy way to find common ground. And I always like to kind of pitch it to where you find the common ground, but then you find the opposite sides. Yeah. I want to know where you stand, who you're rooting for, why you root for them. And then, you know, you kind of draw that wedge between the two and say, well, you're on one side and I'm on another. You know, it's like right. This natural way of carving out some sort of opposition.
Yeah, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, but really, like, you're a Lakers fan?
Yeah.
All right, that's it.
Exactly, no. Exactly, right? We're on opposite sides of the table here, and we got something on the line.
Of course.
So that's usually kind of how I've approached it.
Oh, okay. Kind of start with your journey to becoming a broadcaster, you know, what did it take to get you to where you were? Where did you start? You know, what was that? What's that story?
Boy, we're going down memory lane here. Yeah. But it's something that goes back to needing to be involved in sports. It's a, you know, it's a standard story. Nothing too out of the ordinary. When I was in college, I knew I needed to be involved in sports. I knew part of the reason why I went to USC was to be around a big time sports program, to try to get involved some way, and then segue that into a professional career. I've always liked to chatter. I've always liked to debate. I've always liked to argue, and I've figured, well, I might as well talk because I can't play sports. You know, just like most people, that when they get to college, they realize that they're no longer going to pursue their sports career. So it was easy to get involved with the student radio station at the time. And there were a lot of opportunities, and they were willing to give me a chance. And that's kind of how you get your feet wet. And so I started broadcasting USC baseball. And then that led to doing USC football. And I never did USC basketball, of all things. That was like a different part of the radio station department. And I started doing more and more and being around more and more events. I couldn't do enough because I just knew that I needed to get better and to get as experienced as I possibly could as a broadcaster. And so I started living in Heritage Hall, which was the athletic building at USC, and got in touch with the right people and got involved in the video department. And so they started putting me on more and more events, and I got in touch with them, and I basically just told myself as my USC time went on that, hey, this is something that I want to do for a living. And essentially, if I can get a job post-college, I'm going to go and do it. Now, before that, I made the decision I'm going to put all my chips on the table. I was a political science major. I was not a broadcast major, which is a very popular broadcast major at US, or popular major at USC. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be too limited. I wanted to have sort of a diverse background in my college career. And so I was able to do all that broadcasting on the side, as well as be a political science major. And I remember having these classes. It was right during the 2006 midterm elections when we'd have all these speakers and volunteers come in to try to tell us about the propositions and the initiatives that were on the ballot. We could get involved and we could go and work for them if we wanted to. And if they were successful, it'd probably mean that you could easily get a job post-college. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting in there in these classes being like, oh, that's great. You know, why not try to get involved? But then when I took it a step further, I'd tell myself, well, I have to probably miss doing a game or something. And I didn't want to miss doing any games. And that to me was the easy decision of, you want to be a sports broadcaster more than you want to be in politics. So it was easy to make that decision. I put all my chips on the table. I went all in and then decided to go the minor league baseball route right around graduation.
Well, when you say decided, so what were your other choices?
Well, at that point, I didn't really know. I didn't know how to make it happen other than minor league baseball to a certain extent. Because my thinking was at the time, I wanted to do baseball. I liked it. I needed to become a better broadcaster. I needed the reps. And the job opportunities were in minor league baseball because you could go to the baseball winter meetings every single year and there'd be this massive job fair where all these low-level baseball teams would post broadcasting jobs. And I figured I could go get one and try to work my way up. That was the plan. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say the plan at the time when you're senior in college. And so I went to Nashville in 07, which is where they were. I brought my demo CD and dropped it off in the box with hundreds of other CDs. And
have you made a demo CD lately?
Not yes, I've made a TV demo, absolutely.
Right, but did you physically use a CD?
Not a CD. No, it's all digital. It's all digital now. But I still have some old blank discs, and I still have all my old my old demo CDs, which are
that's cool,
which are still around there. And I'm afraid to go back and listen to them because you're like that does not sound very good at all. But they exist. They're out there, and it was an interesting experience. I left USC without having graduated, which was something I had to convince my parents because I ended up getting a job, and I still had Spanish 3 to do, and I hadn't finished or gotten my degree. Wow. And so it was a little bit of a risk of, well, am I going to be able to come back and get this at some point, or am I just going to end up doing minor league baseball for the next however long, and then how am I going to get that final requirement to ultimately get my degree?
There are baseball teams in Mexico. I know this because I played college baseball and semi-pro, and you know Mexico is an option, so you could learn Spanish there.
Well, I wasn't in Mexico. I definitely wasn't in Mexico. I needed to. If USC was taking classes from Mexico, I probably would have done it if I could do minor league baseball at the same time.
Yeah, but there are, like, it could be worse. You know,
it could have been worse, but it ended up working out. I got a job because I asked just a random question to one of the assistant general managers in the hallway to one of the teams that I applied for, got a conversation started about everything other than broadcasting, because they want you to do so many things. It's like it's literally unpaid labor. Right. There's no other way to put it, because there's so many people that want the jobs, and so broadcasters just want to broadcast, and yet the front office staff wants you to do everything but broadcast.
Right.
So if you can show a little bit of interest that you want to do other things other than broadcasting, it can go a long way, and it did for me.
That's cool. That's awesome. Yeah. Did you ever come to a point where, you know, going in your broadcast route where you were conflicted with another opportunity and you really had to choose, like, okay, I have this opportunity available. You know, there might be more money, or you know, you might be better in some type of way, or I can just stick to my guns and I'm going to continue going after broadcasting.
Yeah, there's always these subtle little decisions that you make that tend to be big in retrospect as to affecting your career. There's a couple that stand out. Number one, after that first year of broadcasting in Potomac, which is the advanced day baseball team that I was working for, the Potomac Nationals, I had an option of staying on the East Coast and selling in the off season, selling billboards, advertisement, or I could go back to California, finish Spanish at a junior college, and then transferred over to USC and try to do broadcasting in the off season, whether it be football or basketball or whatever. And I, in my mind, was like, there's no way I'm staying on the East Coast and just selling and not broadcasting something. And I left the job. I left this job that I really, really wanted just a couple of months ago with nothing else firmly in stone. And it was a little bit of a risk at the time, not knowing where I was going to end up, because I knew that if I left the Peanuts, I was going to have to go through the process all over again. But it ended up working out. Making a long story short, I ended up working for another minor league baseball team up in Eugene. It took a while for that to happen, but that basically took my career on a different trajectory. And then it happened again when I was offered a job after my first year in, where was it? It was after my first year in Eugene. I was offered the USC women's basketball job by somebody that I know within the athletic department because they started to broadcast those games. And I remember thinking, well, it's women's basketball. Do I really want to broadcast women's basketball? But in my mind, I'm like, well, why wouldn't I do USC women's basketball? I want to broadcast. It's another way to get better. It's with USC. And so it ended up being like a no-brainer. And then that segued into something else. So there's all of these like little decisions that you make along the way that seem to have big ramifications, little decisions that end up having big ramifications down the line.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's like you've got this knack about yourself where you literally just stick to your guns on what you want to do. And then I feel like there's a lot of people that just don't do that, you know, when something comes up. And I, you know, what do you think that is about you?
It's simple. And I see it sometimes with athletes. And I talk about it now just in casual conversation. And the line is basically betting on yourself. Mm-hmm. I will bet on myself 10 out of 10. Just because I guess it comes from having the confidence in my own ability to be able to make something happen. And when I say I talk about it now, there's no better example than Baker Mayfield in college football. Baker Mayfield bet on himself not once, but twice, and it paid off big time. He walked on at Texas Tech, won the job, got hurt, lost the job, transferred to Oklahoma on his own, walked onto the football team at Oklahoma, won the job, and then won the Heisman. That, to me, is betting on yourself. And if you have the confidence in yourself that you can do it, I think that that can go a long way because you have the conviction. And if there's one thing inside of me that I always had, it was that that's what I was supposed to be doing because I felt that it was right. And I had the confidence in myself that I'd be able to make it happen.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one thing that people, they hesitate a lot. They might not have the same conviction. And for me, it's gone a long ways.
Yeah, it certainly has. I mean, proof is in the pudding, you know, for another sport reference.
There's another guy who has always bet on himself, John Calipari. Mm-hmm. John Calipari was like, I don't care. I'm going to be successful. I'm going to go to UMass. I'll be successful. I don't care. I'm going to go to Memphis. I'll be fine. One job after another when everyone was writing him off. And he was like, I'll be okay because I've got the confidence in my ability to relate to players, to recruit, to coach, to get the results that I know that I can get.
That guy, Anytime I see him, he's just like a phenomenal public speaker. He just knows how to talk to people. I mean, he obviously knows how to coach, but I mean, the ability to talk to people.
Totally.
Anytime he's on air, I've actually met him personally one time, and he's just like, he's charismatic. He's like, I feel like he might be the Dick Vitale of our era, maybe.
Well, Dick's in a sort of echelon of his own in terms of enthusiasm and what he's done for the college game. I mean, but Calipari, he's been a good coach. But bet on yourself. Bet on yourself. Because nobody is going to care, Seth, nobody's going to care more about your career than you. Like the old saying, nobody's going to care more about your money than you.
Yeah.
No one's going to care more about your career than you. And you're the one that's going to be able to put the most into that, whatever it may be, because everything today is competitive. Everything. Talking about getting into college for college kids, going to law school, trying to get a job outside of law school. There's going to be going to medical school, trying to become a doctor. It doesn't matter what you're doing.
Yeah.
There's going to be 100 other people that are trying to do the exact same thing that you are. It's up to you to be able to find the space. As they always say, there's always room at the top.
Always.
There's always room at the top. And it's I think it's kind of up to you and up to the individual to try to find that space and how you're going to do it. It's not easy, but there's always going to be competition. You kind of have to embrace it and say, this is who I am, and I'm not going to worry about what everyone else is doing because I need to care about myself.
Yeah. I think this is a good segue to ask another question. You know, when you were younger, you had an accident, didn't you?
Well, I was in high school. I was 17 at the time, and was in a car accident that, you know, changed my life pretty significantly. At the time, I was 17 and just a high school junior, night before homecoming, and out with a couple of buddies, and the driver couldn't handle a left turn in the road, and the car flipped onto me, being in the passenger seat, and the car crunched into a ditch and essentially broke my neck, damaged my spinal cord at C5, C6, and I ended up being paralyzed for 7 months. So it was quite the curveball, and it's been something that's been with me ever since, and about almost 17 years ago. So that's definitely been something that's affected my life and my thinking and made me grow up really, really, really quickly at a very young age to put life in perspective, to put my journey in perspective, to put what I wanted to get out of life in perspective. So, and it happened quite young in retrospect, but, you know, nothing you can do about it.
Do you think that has anything to do with your perspective and how you go about things? Like literally when that happens to some folks, you can either quit on yourself or you can, you know, get through the rehab. And I mean, I'm sure you were scared as shit when that happened.
That scares me
to even hear the story.
Here's the thing. I had one small reference in my brain of my situation, and it was, I couldn't feel or move anything from the chest down, right? Couldn't feel or move anything. I was stuck. And the only thing that I had in my mind that came close to that was Christopher Reeve. I don't know if you remember the actor, former Superman. And he, I remember, always couldn't move or couldn't feel. And he was paralyzed. He was in a wheelchair. And that was my only reference. And I was like, well, I don't want to be that. Mm-hmm. But I was 17 and too dumb and naive to realize what had happened. I was too just sort of inexperienced to understand the ramifications of what had just happened to me and what I was about to face and what I was going through.
Right.
And so that eased me because, honestly, I was like, I don't have to go to school on Monday. I'm not even kidding. I was like, this means I don't have to go to freaking school because I hated
got that science test.
I hated school. I hated it. And it kind of like freed me to a certain extent. And as bass-ackward as that sounds, it freed me to a certain extent. And I was like, well, okay, I can just focus on rehab. I'll just get better and I'll be fine. And I'll get out of my wheelchair. It never crossed my mind that I would be paralyzed. Like it never crossed my mind that I would spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. I was very fortunate that I had a ton, endless, amounts, a bottomless amount of support from my family, my friends, my community, my high school, the people that were closest to me who provided me everything that I could have ever wanted to get me out of that wheelchair. I mean, there were sacrifices up and down the line, and I was very fortunate to have that in place and to have that structure in place that made that happen.
Do you remember any moments in particular with anyone or even just with yourself where you were just like, you know what, this is tough, but this happened and I'm going to get through this?
No.
Fair enough.
No. I mean, it just sort of happened. It wasn't fun. It wasn't pleasurable. The ICU sucked. I couldn't move. Couldn't eat. I had tubes all over myself, one in each nostril, one down my throat to help me breathe. I was on a rotating bed back and forth. They couldn't pull the tube out because I wasn't strong enough to breathe. Mm-hmm. Doctor's like, we pull that out, you'll die. You can't breathe. You're not strong enough. You only have your diaphragm. You have nothing else. So it took me about 2 weeks to stabilize. That was terrible. But I was like, it's okay. We'll get through it. And then it was one thing after another. There was just these little benchmarks of progression that I started to expect, that I started to believe in. Okay, so you get out of the ICU, you go down to rehab. Well, in a month, you know, you start getting a little movement in your thumb. Okay, a month later, you start to get movement and feeling in your lower extremities, and that's a huge step. It was just a step-by-step process of me believing that good things were going to come. Part being dumb, part being positive, part having my family support and my friend support. So it was this collection of things. If there's one thing that I will say about the process is I was 100% positive through it all. 100% positive. And that, I think, played a big part.
Do you feel you're still that way as well in everything that you do?
You try to. Those things were so monumental back then, and you're so young, and it's newness to it, that it's easy to be more positive. Now, it's more appreciation positivity than it is anything else, rather than like, oh my God, well, what do I have to look forward to, you know, what's coming up next in terms of maybe a physical accomplishment? It doesn't really work that way. It's more of a positive appreciation and trying to make a difference in a positive way for other people, for the people that you come across, for your work, your job, all those little things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, you have the Olympics going on right now, right? And some of these athletes have trained so hard to get there. And like, take Lindsey Vonn. She's a big name. Over the last, 4 years, she got injured.
And probably the last 8 years. I mean, she's been up and down her whole career with injuries.
Was it a spine surgery? It was some type of back surgery, I think.
She's had ACLs. She's had backs. She's had just about everything.
Yeah, and I mean, I can only just imagine her mindset just going forward into whatever competition that she's getting into, because there have been so many setbacks, but she, I think like you, just kept on believing in herself.
Well, there is a certain mentality that and tenacity that I think that some people have.
Yeah.
I get defiant, and I'm sure that she does too. When you get injured, it's almost like there is no way I'm going to let this thing beat me. I might get beat by my opposition because they were better than me, but I'm not going to let a knee injury get the better of me. And I think that that might just be an element of defiance, an element of competitiveness that runs in certain people. I know that I get incredibly defiant sometimes to not let my injury define who I am. If there's some physical obstacle that I want to accomplish, I'll just get it in my head not to be denied. And I'll just keep telling myself not to be denied until I accomplish what I want to accomplish.
That's so cool. So there's a story that I kind of want to share.
Yeah.
On that note, it's when I was at Dixie State. It was my freshman year in college. I was playing baseball there, and my supra and infraspinatus in my scapula, it was blocked. So I had nerve damage. I couldn't lift a gallon of milk with my right arm, And I didn't know why until I actually got an MRI and the doctor showed me what was going on. And I remember being in the locker room and telling some of my teammates, and this one guy, his name's Tony, I won't put the last name, but he's like, "You're done. Like, just go do something else." And from that moment on, I was like, fuck you. Fuck that mentality.
Yeah.
I'm going to get back, and whether I'm playing here or elsewhere, I'm going to prove it to myself and everyone else, even though I don't need to prove it to everyone else. But it was just like, I'm not going to lose here. I'm not going to let this defeat me.
There's something that I think gets people's attention more so than anything else when they are told they can't do something, or you're not allowed to do something because of this, or we're not going to let you do this. And then all of a sudden it clicks in your brain. Well, why not? What is preventing me from doing that? And then it just like recalibrates your entire thinking.
Yeah.
Your entire mentality. Sometimes that's what it takes. You can't do you can't go and throw a baseball anymore. Oh, well, let me show you. Actually, I can.
Yeah.
Or you're not going to get drafted because of this. Oh, I'm not? Just watch.
Right.
Let me show you. This is how it's done.
Yeah.
So there's something that kind of gets hit. It's like a switch.
Right. It's interesting psyche too, because even coaches use it sometimes on their players, and even managers in you know, corporate jobs. Well, you might not be right for the job, and like they know what they're doing too.
Power motivation.
Yeah,
100%.
It's crazy.
And some people have buttons that get pushed differently than others, and some people know how to push those buttons. Some of it comes internally by what happens to you, like what happened to me, or maybe what happened to Lindsey Vonn with all those injuries. But somehow, some way, those buttons are in there.
Right.
You just got to find a way to hit them the right sequence.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's with athletes, at least, you know, they find a way to, I don't know, mentally excel and physically excel when those buttons are pushed. And it's just like a beautiful thing.
You know? Totally. Some people can handle criticism. Some people can't. Some people need to be handled with gloves. Some people don't. I mean, some people need to be really pushed because things come easier to them. So it's just finding it within yourself. What's it going to take?
Yeah, like each person's unique, and you know, not everyone's the same.
100%.
Now we were having a conversation earlier today about Twitter, and I wanted to bring this up because, you know, you're a public figure, you're on TV, you're on radio, and there's context into what you say because you can hear it, you can see it. But on Twitter, sometimes like there's no context, and words and phrases can be taken for, you know, just the wrong way. How do you kind of manage that?
Let me just say, I love Twitter first and foremost. Yeah. I am on Twitter more than my fair share throughout the day, more than I should be. I mean, it is, for all of its good and all of its bad, I end up there more than I like to admit. Now, with that said, Twitter is what you make out of it. Because, yes, it can be an intellectual wasteland, 100%. I mean, it is garbage sometimes.
Right.
But you can follow who you want to follow. And there are some very smart people on Twitter. And if you are in any kind of information gathering world, which I am, I love to read and I love to figure out what is going on in the world. There are very smart writers out there who post all of their stuff on Twitter. So it doesn't matter whether it's a sports columnist. It doesn't matter whether it's something from the Wall Street Journal. It's all going on Twitter. And you can tailor what information you want to get from the writers that you like. And that's where I tend to go for my Twitter information. You get nuance and this and that because there's people that are closer to certain situations on topics that you want to get more information about. Now, the flip side of that is who's doing the tweeting. And for me, there's no tweeting going on. And part of that is, I I don't trust myself in getting into it with people because there is no context. I think it's a completely loaded gun. I think it can be a one-way road to nowhere. And just there's so many people who get angry, who hide behind their keyboard, and it can blow up into nothing. And I just don't want to deal with that. I don't have enough time.
Right.
I don't want to tweet. There's a ton of ideas that I have, and I'd be like, well, that might actually be a good tweet sometimes, because, you know, you text your friends, and I'm like, I just got to get this off my chest.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this popped into my head, and I've got to get it off my chest. They're going to hear it whether they want to or not. They're gonna hear my thoughts on this situation. They can ignore the text, but they're going to hear it.
Right.
Sometimes I just have to get stuff off my chest. But I haven't gotten to that point yet to where I think that it's a good idea with Twitter, just because who knows what people are going to react to. And then, you know, you start to get upset with what they're saying, and it's just like one thing after another. And I don't think I have the patience for it. And I don't think it can be, I don't think it can end well.
So, I mean, I've got to bring it up. I've got to ask because we're on it, but yeah. You know, obviously the president tweets a lot.
To and his advantage.
That's what I was going to ask. Do you think it's good? Do you think it's bad? I mean,
I think it's terrible because we have now, as a society, we have fallen into this tweeting world where one-liners are the rule of the land. Attacks are a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And it gets taken as, you know, the end all means of what that person's trying to say without context. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's a good habit to get into. And, you know, the president has used it very effectively for his supporters to sort of play off and to get in attack mode and to use it as a deflection to change away from what really is the story of that particular day. And he's used it as a powerful tool, knowing how many people are on Twitter and knowing the effect that it has. But that's the world that we live in now. We're a social media driven society that is hooked.
So going like one step further, in politics, do you think we'll start seeing more public figures in these positions because they have so many followers and it's like,
well,
are seeing.
The interesting thing about that is, and there's no better example than what has taken place recently with LeBron James and Laura Ingram, and how these little quibbles are playing out in social media. I mean, texting back and forth in public. You see these people that have these platforms like LeBron James who are now speaking out more and more on social and political issues. And that is one way that it could be a benefit. I mean, giving these guys a voice because they never used to have an individual voice. They'd always have to go through the media, right? They'd have to go through a newspaper or through a magazine or some author to write a book or something like that. Those to me are ways in which Twitter can be a benefit. There's ways in which these athletes and people in a position of power can get out a positive message.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. I mean, nowadays you have just an endless audience. It's massive. You can reach people in any country, anywhere, anytime.
Well, not only that, but you don't have to be in a certain city to be a star. I was listening to Brian Windhorst of ESPN basically say, you know, this isn't 1995 all over again. You do not have to be in LA or New York or Chicago in the biggest market with all the glitz to be a star. All you got to do is have social media and be on a team. And, you know, Russell Westbrook's poster is on 14 different billboards in LA during All-Star Week. And who does he play for? He plays for Oklahoma City.
Right, yeah.
You don't need a big city to be a star anymore. Doesn't matter where you are.
Yeah.
Does not so matter true. Where you are. So for that, I mean, there's so many different avenues with social media and Twitter and Instagram and this and that. It's endless. Honestly, where's it going to go? I have no idea.
Right. Yeah.
I have no idea.
It's like it's exciting and it's scary all at the same time, you know. I do want to ask you this, because I've been trying to think about it and I just don't know. Where is LeBron going to be next season?
I have been saying Houston. I think he's going to end up in Houston. And I say that because in this day and age in the NBA, the way that things are operating is essentially if there's a will, there's a way. Now, you look at some of the numbers and how they could somehow fit him in, and it's not pretty. They'd have to clear house while trying to keep a core of Chris Paul, James Harden, Clint Capella, Eric Bledsoe, and then LeBron. It's almost impossible to try to fill out an entire roster when you have those contracts and then you try to fit LeBron in. Yeah. I just feel like there's a way that they would be able to kind of figure it out. Now, if he does think that winning is his number one priority, I think that that's the best possible place for him, even if it does mean coming over to the West. I figure Chris Paul, who's one of his best friends, and James Harden would give him a better chance to win than anything the Lakers can put together going forward next year. Even if they were to bring in Paul George, I still don't think that's enough to take down the Warriors. And going in with James Harden and Chris Paul is by far the best way for him to try to accumulate more titles. It's not going to come in Cleveland. Houston's the number one spot. And if that's what he cares about the most, because you don't need to be in L.A. to be a star, he's got his whole rest of his life to come and live in L.A. and live in his Brentwood house, go and try to get your titles. If that's what's most important to you, I don't see why you wouldn't.
What about OKC? Joining Paul George and Melo and Russ.
That is another possible destination, I guess. I never really thought about OKC in that way.
Like, what if it wasn't OKC, but it was like the same roster elsewhere? It's like
I see what you're saying. Isn't that a possibility? Yeah, you know, they've got tremendous. Of course, Paul George, Russell Westbrook, Steven Adams. You hook up LeBron, and they are they're pretty nasty.
Yeah.
I will say this about LeBron, and it's starting to emerge more and more about all of his power and sort of his effect on things. Everyone talks about where does he stand with Jordan and one of the greatest players of all time. He's got three titles. But LeBron, in all of his greatness, his biggest sort of legacy point to me is going to be empowering the modern-day athlete, and particularly the modern-day NBA player, because he has so much pull with culture and society and the sports fan world, because he's such a megastar that you see he's basically been operating on his own volition year after year, whether it be these one-year contracts, whether it be holding the NBA hostage with where he wants to go and play, and basically giving the power to the players of you guys can go and say where you want to play. I think that is going to be a lasting effect in the NBA. And I think it's going to start to infiltrate other sports as well, because he's basically saying, I am not going to let a team or a general manager dictate where my career goes. And we're seeing that more and more when, athletes would just, they'd get drafted, they sign, and that's where they'd play, or they'd get traded and this and that. And they wouldn't have nearly as much power over the teams. Teams would have power over the players, but that's starting to shift. And it's all because of LeBron.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really good point. Never really even thought about that. And you see that happening with, a few other players too. Would you say maybe even that started with Kobe?
No, because we knew Kobe was going to be a Laker for life.
Right.
And Kobe was about one thing only, and that was about winning championships with the Lakers. Even though he requested a trade and he wanted to go, the Lakers didn't grant him the trade. But I don't necessarily feel like Kobe had the same thrust that LeBron does when it comes to being able to have his way, period. I mean, LeBron does what LeBron wants. LeBron does what LeBron wants. Year after year after year, we've seen it. Teams lining up for his services, being able to dictate his own contracts. By all means, he's the greatest player in the world. How can you not? And he has that much impact. So now not everybody's going to have that kind of weight, but there's plenty of people and there's plenty of stars in the years to come who will.
Right, yeah, and it's going to be exciting for us to just kind of sit back and watch. It'll be cool to be a part of that.
100%.
Yeah.
But I think Houston, to answer your original question.
Okay.
I think he goes to Houston. I never thought of OKC. I don't know. I haven't really studied their financial situation, but...
I think they have the cap room. If I looked it up. I'm not 100% positive, but I think they do have the room for him. It just...
Well, Melo's a free agent, and you'd think that with Russell Westbrook getting the max and Paul George needing a nice hefty salary, they'd have to find a way to squeeze those three big chunks in.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I think we're going to get another primetime LeBron.
No.
Where are you going?
No. No, that disaster is not going to be repeated. That disaster will not be repeated. But it's going to be fascinating. I mean, he's not going to be the only one on the move. That's for sure. If he decides to leave. I mean, NBA free agency has turned into... The NBA as a whole is probably the biggest soap opera around. I mean, it's just endless now.
Well,
it is a year-round soap opera. I mean, who's not on Twitter these days looking for Woj bombs?
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. It's interesting what the NBA does over any other league, because you look at football, they keep it very team-oriented. You're not really looking at certain players. But the NBA, when it's the Celtics versus the Cavs, it's not the Celtics versus the Cavs. It's Kyrie versus LeBron. Mm-hmm. Or when it's, the Pistons versus the Clippers, it's not the Pistons versus the Clippers. It's Blake Griffin versus... Right. DeAndre Jordan.
Star versus star.
Yeah, it's very, very personal. They keep it very personal, which is interesting. And I think it is just, it's blown up for them, and they're doing it the right way. They're up with the times.
Not only that, but it's getting more and more ridiculous in how fans and even teams, see with the Lakers in terms of, and the Lakers and the Warriors in terms of cap positioning, for players who still have 2 years left on their deals.
Yeah.
2 years. And the Lakers are talking about trying to get Klay Thompson in the summer of 2019 or Boogie Cousins. I mean, it's unbelievable to me how once you hit that 2 year mark from when 2 years left on your contract, how all of a sudden you're fair game.
Yeah. It's
because maybe you might want to move. You lose the leverage like the Indiana did with Paul George with just 1 year left on the deal. So it becomes 2 years out now, like, oh, Klay Thompson might want to go to L.A. because he's got 2 years left and the Warriors might want to trade him and they don't have to pay it. It's ridiculous.
Right, and it's like 2 years is a long time. Like that's,
so much can happen between now and 2019.
Right. Yeah, you've got that, you got, what's his name? The young kid coming up in high school. I forgot his name, but LeBron went to his game and... It was all over social media.
Zion.
Yeah. Like he's coming up. Whoever is in his class is coming up. And it's like there's other players that are going to be available, you know, that are young talents that you have to also account for. But no, you're right. I mean, it's like, well, this guy's going to be available in 2 years. So let's start thinking about that.
Yeah. That's just in the NBA. These guys are available 2 years out. Is he going to be coming? Is he going to want to leave? Who knows?
Right.
See. So.
Well, before we get wrapped up here, the whole purpose of the podcast is, you know, success and perspective in all walks of life. I'm so excited that you are the first person on because you're a sports guy. And, you know,
we could talk all day about sports. I could talk to you about any sport you want to all day, Seth, if we could keep going.
Oh, yeah. And like, well, we certainly will after the podcast for sure. But, you know, just if there's anything else that you'd like to voice out, you know, in your opinion of what it takes to get to where you want to go, you know, whether that's broadcasting or, you know, anything.
I guess this is a question of sort of a grand philosophy to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And for me, I guess that the one thing that I've told people when it comes to trying to find, because number one, the hardest thing is finding what you want to do. What makes you tick? What makes you want to get up and attack the day, attack the world to accomplish something? What makes you want to do that? Once you find that, I think that it becomes crystal clear, because I'm sure everyone's felt it at some point. When you're doing something, whatever it might be, whether it's broadcasting your game or being at a sporting event or volunteering or you know, becoming a doctor and helping people in that way, there's a certain feeling that you get in that this is what I feel like I'm supposed to be doing. I always felt that home when I was at a live sporting event. I always was like, this is where I want to be right now. This is where I'm supposed to be. And that gave conviction in that this is what I'm supposed to do. And for people to find what they love and to have that feeling, don't give up on it. Like, if there's something that you believe that you're supposed to do, and that's what you're supposed to be doing for your life and your career, because it makes you happy and it makes you motivated and it makes you want to help others, do it. Don't give up on it. Because there's nothing else that's gonna motivate you to accomplish life. And then you start getting into the category of, well, I'm just working to work, or I'm working for a paycheck. And you feel like your life is this big, vacuous bag of nothing. Because you're like, I'm not doing what I want to do. Yeah. And I'm not happy. But if there's something that you believe that you're supposed to do, because that's what you believe you are, who you are, do it.
Cool.
That's it. That kind of got me through, I guess, my low moments of right out of college. But I wasn't going to give up on it.
That's awesome. Where can people find you online?
Online? Like for Twitter?
Twitter, Instagram.
I am on Instagram, Fishsticks, I guess. I travel a lot. It's mostly just travel. Not much else. And Twitter, I don't tweet really pretty much ever. I got a handful of followers here. I think I tweeted out a starting lineup for USC men's basketball and opening tip off a few years ago, but CFishSticks, CFishSticks is the Twitter handle. Cool. So,
all right.
Other than that, man, it's been fun, as always.
Yeah.
Nice chatting it up with you, and hopefully we can do it again. And it's only going to get better from here. You know, we set the bar pretty low, and then it's just only
going to go up and up
from this point forward.
Get out of here. No, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Seriously. Thanks for coming on, and, you know, we'll definitely do this again.
Sounds good. Anytime.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to the first podcast. I really appreciate you. You can go ahead now and subscribe to my podcast on whichever platform you're using. And also, I would love for you to contact me. My Instagram is at Seth Markson. That's at SethMarkzon. For Twitter, it's at S Markson. That's at SMarkzon. Facebook, just look me up, Seth Markson. If you'd like to get in touch with Chris, you can do so on Instagram at Fishsticks. That's at FishSticks. Hey, thank you so much again for listening in. I definitely have more guests lined up with awesome conversations, and I want you to listen in.